Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 17, delivered on April 1, 2019. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. Before we get started, the usual look at the numbers. And I usually don't podcast this part of the lecture, but today I will, because I'm going to move in from there to a specific stock to give you some fleshing out of things I've talked about before, and it'll allow me to move forward into the day's lecture. So the first thing we want to do is have a look at the numbers. And as I always do, I ask, Madam, good day or bad? Oh, well, let's try that one more time. There, that should help. Madam, good day or bad day on the street? Very strong day up on all fronts. We had across the board the... And clearly, this was a day that was biased towards the smaller companies. If you notice, the largest companies, well, it's actually kind of mixed bag. Largest and smallest, with the S&P 500 in the middle. Now, the reason I'm showing you this right now is there are some interesting information about the markets as a whole versus one of the companies in the news right now. Is anyone familiar with the markets like Uber and all of that? You've used Uber? Well, one of those companies just did an IPO, Lyft. And the IPO came off last week at 72 a share. The stock went up to 90 or so, and then it went down to 69. And I've told you about how this works before. The IPO goes off. The clients who are the favorites of the investment banks are given the privilege of getting in at the 72, and then it goes up, 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 push it up, hype it, and then they dump. And upon whom do they dump? I'll bet you didn't know that your middle name is Sucker. I've been working with you for a long time, and I know you heard about Lyft and its IPO. Well, it's gone from 72 to 90, and I've got some of it I can get for you. Are you in? Are you in?
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. And as that sell-off goes forward and the price corrects downward, well, you see, you just bought all those insiders and those big, big money people, the clients of the investment banks. You bought them a few extra martinis for their lunch. That's how it works. I mean, it's unfortunate that that's how it works, but welcome. Let's look at the 5-day on it. Let me look at the, I wish I could look at a 10-day, 6-month. It's kind of hard to see it here. That's actually, yeah, there's the IPO date. And But it did have a nice little pop there last week. And then the sell-off. See the sell-off right here? See the volume? The sell-off. And then we had another sell-off. There was another sell-off right here. Boom! And now it closed today at 69 and change, 69 and a penny. So it's below its IPO, its offering price. And again, that's not that unusual. So you are a sucker to get in, okay? Now, the insiders would have known part of what's going on. But let's have a look at something interesting here. Let me get back to the original screen. There's not enough information, obviously, to run any a lot of the calculations. And the volume and the average volume really don't mean a whole hell of a lot right now because we've had only a few days of trading. We certainly haven't had a 52-week. Oh, they're saying it didn't make it to 90. It got up to 88.60. Oh, well. Anyway, no dividend, obviously. Is there a number there that really, really should really bother you that is actually being posted in that set of numbers? You see anything that might be noticeable, sir?
The beta is...
There's no beta. It can't have a beta. There's not enough calculation time. What do you see? An actual number, not an NA. Is there a number there that should make your back leg thump up and down, make you scream, run away? Anything?
Earnings per share is negative.
How much negative? A couple of bucks?
$43
per share they've lost. That's not bleeding. That is a horror film where the whole sorority and fraternity get hacked up by Jason bleeding. This company is losing money hand over fist. This is just amazing amount of money that this company is losing. And yet they went public and there were enough suckers to buy billions of dollars in stock. Okay, maybe things are a little better than what I'm saying here. Let's go and look at what the SEC, what the Edgar filings. Now, this company just went public. So we should, right near the top, see the form S10, S1. This was, and I brought this up early in the semester, the different ways that a public offering can go off. Remember, an S1, an SB1, SB2. This would have been a form S1. So let us go over here and type in that trading symbol. Boy, that'll get us to that company real fast. Oh, dear. It's not responding. It says there's no matching ticker symbol. But there it is, Lyft, LYFT. But there's no SEC information searching under the ticker. Yes. Did I? Well, let's try that. LYFT. Still nothing. That was actually on purpose, but never. Try to. It's okay. Well, wait a minute. They filed with the SEC. Why isn't the SEC showing anything? There have to be public documents. There have to be. Oh. The SEC isn't registering the ticker symbol yet, so we're going to have to look for it by the name of the company, Lyft. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. That time, you can't do it that way, with that one, Lyft. Oh, there it is. Brand new. California. Uh-oh, California. Well, there he is, right there, the Form S-1, right in the first page. This thing pushed out its S-1 so we can see the whole registration document, which is a real pain in the butt. But, oh, well, we'll get to those Excel sheets. That'll help us. Uh-oh, no Excel sheets. Doesn't even have Excel sheets up yet for the company's financials. So we're going to have to plow it the hard way, the ouch way. But let's be careful here. Let's make sure there's nothing else. Oh my, they filed an amendment very quickly after the original filing of the S1. They filed an S1 slash A, an amendment to the original offerings documents with the SEC. I see up here something that smells really, really bad, speaking as an old-time consultant, an S8. Now, that is stock that they're going to say, okay, this is stock that we are registering so we can give it to our employees and employee stock option plans. Bullshit. I was a consultant. I wrote S8s for myself and my cronies so that we get paid in stock without having to pay for that stock. And then it would just be part of the offering, just a part of an offering. It would be registered, freely tradable, and it was part of what we did to make our money on without having actual checks written that were tax stuff. So I smell a rat right there. Someone's getting candy. Some insiders, consultants, someone is getting candy. They're not going to. Lyft has no record, track record whatsoever of being good to its drivers at all. So that's not, well, anyway. Okay, let's have a look. Documents. Dear God, we're going to have to look at the actual Form S-1 to get the financials. Okay, here we go. Here it is, Form S-1. The S-1 has a preliminary thing that's almost like a business plan, except it's a structured document. And then the prospectus, which is the selling document that they give to the buyer. And then at the back, they should have the financial statements themselves. So we go through all of this fluff and happiness. Now, trust me when I tell you this. In my time, if we had filed a document with all of this pretty coloring on it, we would have been hanged and graphics and people happy bouncing around. You don't do that to the, you didn't do that to the SEC. They were SEC government people. They were bureaucrats. They had no sense of art. One mission. This is almost like a promo instead of a filing with the SEC, but that's done these days. And by the way, notice up here, look at this red lettering. Do you remember what that red lettering tells you? What is that called? What's a prospectus called that has red lettering on it? Do you remember the term? You don't? Okay. You don't look like the kind of person who's ever eaten it. Do you like sardines? Really? Is there anyone who actually eats sardines? Have any of you ever been to Scandinavia and eaten the fish there? What's their favorite fish? Oh, for the Lord's sake, it's called a red herring. Do you remember now? That's the one with red lettering. It's not a selling document if it has the herring stuff on it, the red herring lettering, the red. But anyway, moving along here. Okay, now we're going to wander around here. Oh, those financial statements have to be here someplace. Oh, well, I see some right here. Okay. Oh, goody. I see. Well, there's our revenue. Okay. Oh, my. 2016 net loss, $682.79 million. In 2017, $688.301 million. 2018, $911 million. We are on a roll, folks. Give them one more year, and they'll hit $1 billion in the red. You begin to get a picture of why this stock, once the big people had gotten their little coin off it, they dumped this thing fast. Let's keep going. Now, I'm being a cynical bastard here, and I hope you will follow in my footsteps. Let's do something. Okay. Let's see what our stockholders' equity. Accumulated deficit. Now, we got to be careful here because that's not going to show me as well as another document would. Come on. I want one that shows directly total stockholders' equity. Well, if the company is losing so much money, how come the total stockholders' equity was going up? Well, that would be as they were making private placements in 2017, and then this giant public offering in 2000, very recently. But as you can see, the total accumulated deficit in terms of just purely what the company has accumulated in losses is $3.6 billion. Now, that was at the end of 2018. So this company in early 2019, just last week, did a public offering for billions of dollars. What that means is that those new shareholders just bailed out the original shareholders. $5 billion, a whole lot of that went to the $3.6 billion original equity investors, the original owners, out of their hole. That's very common. That's why you watch yourself with offerings of stock, because a company that's doing well has no reason to share its wealth. The owners have no reason to share their wealth with more owners. It's only when the owners are in trouble that they're willing to be magnanimous and let you in on some of their big, big ideas. And in this case, oh yeah, that was great. These new shareholders bought in and they provided the $3.6 billion back to the original owners, to the old owners, who had drilled this company down that far, $3.6 billion into the hole. So this offering was essentially a bailout of the original stockholders of the company, of the old stockholders of the company. What do you want to bet some of those old stockholders, the originals in that company? As soon as that stock got close to $90, they were out of there as fast as they could be, which was another reason probably you had some dumping going on the stock. It's just, if you have a chance to get out with your shirt still on, you're going to do it when you thought your shirt was $3.6 billion in the hole. This is why you have to watch it when you get the promo was really strong last week. Oh, this is incredible. Lyft is good. Well, the truth of the matter is that market is actually very immature. It's really hard to call where it is. Lyft is actually not the most interesting. Uber is still dominating, but interestingly enough, dominating by drivers and riders, yes, but you have these low-level competitors like Juno and Via coming in, and they're actually gobbling market share because Uber's gotten too big for it to grasp the details of city by city by city share of the market. So Lyft is standing there, well, we got our money, so let's figure out what we can do with it. Okay, anyway, be careful out there. The world is full of scoundrels and suckers. If you're going to be one, be the scoundrel. Now, back to the original screen here. You got nothing as far as technical analysis goes. You got nothing for this company to tell you what to do. There's no beta. There's no PE ratio to tell you. There's no, obviously, no dividend. All you got is the price, volume, and the earnings per share to guide you. And in a case like that, would you designate? Now, we've got the market has pushed this price down, and probably we're getting closer to a true value for the stock. And most of that true value is probably just based on the present value of growth opportunities. Now, do you consider this, sir, to be a safe stock or a risky stock?
Risky.
Yeah, you think? Yeah. Especially when you don't have information. That is a risk factor from hell, the less you know. Okay, if you are driving down the road and you see way out in front of you, you know, even if there are things there, It's not that risky because, you know, but you go out on one of these prairie roads on an early spring night when there's fog. I mean, and you can't see 10 feet in front of the car, but you know damn well there's something bad out there, like a clown. Or maybe one of those Blair Witch Project things, or, you know, a Rougarou, or a worst of all, a werewolf. Oh, okay. So the risk is greater just because you can't see in front of you. And, of course, that's what makes you more afraid. You know, when you see a clown in broad daylight, that's nothing like seeing a clown walking up to you at midnight saying, hi. In broad daylight, you know, well, that's a clown. Run! At night, you just sit there, I'm going to die. Anyway, so the fact that we don't have any information other than actually the only hard information we have in terms of numbers is bad information. The good information is all soft information. Well, we hear this great thing, or I took a lift and it worked for me. Well, I took a lift and I got murdered by this crazy psycho who was pretending to be a Lyft driver. Well, that was Uber, wasn't it? Anyway, but this, all the positive information is fluff. All the negative information is what we have that's hard. So in a case like that, when, I mean, are you going to believe the promoters of Lyft, or are you going to believe your lying eyes when you look at that income statement? That's what it boils down to. So if you're assigning a beta to this, just take a stab in the dark, maybe 2, 2.5, something like that. That's all you can do. Now, this is critical to the lecture today because the lecture today is about the capital asset pricing model, which is, it was actually developed years ago. Oh, you know what's really killing me? I think it's like a half century ago. And when I first started talking about it, I said, this is a relatively modern, new construct. And now I can say, yeah, this is a half century old. Oddly, though, over the years since it was developed by these financial economists who had come out of World War II, where they'd done a lot of developing of theoretical work that was applied to warfare, they came out and they started using these skills that they were developing, new understandings, and they developed this capital asset pricing model. And I'll show it to you here in just a minute. It's really simple. It's actually ridiculously simple. It's one of those things, is that all there is to it? But over the years since then, there have been a couple of attempts to do something that was better or more relevant or more complete. But really, honestly, there hasn't been a real knockout of the CAPM, and it's still used quite widely in corporate finance, even in this kind of finance. Now, there is a new model that has come. The first actual uses of the model were in the mid-90s. And I'm seeing that coming up more and more now with very, very large industrial and high technology companies. They've moved beyond CAPM. They've moved beyond present value, net present value. They've moved beyond all of that to this new thing called the options pricing model to determine project worthiness and all of that kind of stuff. But for the most part, it's still the CAPM's world. Here's how it works. Looking at some. Sir, you. Have you ever done push-ups? Okay, you've done push-ups. Yeah. Okay, now, you've done 10, right? You've done one. Okay, you've done one, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now, when you go from 0 to 1, you notice that it's actually not that hard. Go from 10 to 11, that's just one, and it's harder. You go from 100 to 101, and you sound like you ate too much cheese before the day before. Hold up. You see, there's an efficiency. Now, you can drink protein drinks. You can follow those guys on TV. My name is Sven, and I'm going to teach you to have bulging, rippling muscles like me. But there's still only so far any individual can go before it's over. The same is true when we see performance of aircraft, performance of cars. There's only so much you can do before you can't get any more out of the engine, any more speed, any more gas efficiency, whatever it is. You throw in a few bucks and you get some more speed. You throw in a lot more and you get a few more miles per hour. You throw in insane amounts more and you can barely get the speed any higher. The same is true of natural objects as well. As stars stabilize their nuclear fires at the center, they burn them more and more efficiently, but there's a point where their efficiency is just no greater. It can't get any better. That star, given its parameters, cannot get any hotter than a certain temperature. All of these are examples of something that we see also in the world of finance in a lot of ways, but here's one of them. If I were on the vertical axis I won't even write expected return. I'll just write the return. Now, this could be the return to a stock. It could be the return to a portfolio. Because technically, a single stock is a portfolio of one security. And on this axis right here, I'm going to write the risk measured by the standard deviation, sigma, of that stock. Okay, now this would be actually what we have done. And I mean, more research, PhD dissertations and low-level journal articles have been done doing it. Actually, okay, let's look at this stock and we can plot its standard deviation and its return. Okay, we'll look at a little portfolio right there. Let's look at a big, huge portfolio. Different stocks, different little, big, massive, huge, significant, insignificant. Oh, here's Microsoft right here. Literally, that would be about where it is on this little crappy chart that I'm doing. Okay, little stocks all over the place. Here a stock, there a stock, everywhere a stock. Old McInvestor had a portfolio, EIEIO. I'm trying to be entertaining. For God's sake, snicker. Pretend to snicker. Damn it. You're good. Now, we can do this for thousands, literally hundreds of thousands. And I've got a scatter plot. If I can find that stupid scatter plot, I'll actually put it up on the scrolling marquee on my podcasting website tonight, a link to it, that was done with thousands of stocks and portfolios to create the scatter plot. But what's interesting is that we see something that we see all through nature. There is a place where no more X's show up. We see this in all kinds of performance analyses of automobiles, gas mileage, plane speeds, you name it, human activity. There is a point where you will get no more muscle mass, no matter how hard you work. And it's actually individual. To some extent, there's a few other factors in there. But you see, in physics, we call this place, this where it ends, we call it an envelope. The term is envelope. There's an old, it was popular back in the 90s, a yuppie term, pushing the envelope. And people thought that meant moving an envelope forward. No, you fools, it has to do with this envelope in physics, trying to bump it up. It's there and it is pretty much rock solid unless a new technology comes along to change the boundary. But in finance, we call that the efficient frontier of investments. The efficient frontier of investments. It's real. It's real. It actually is there. It says that there is a certain place where, for a given risk, you can get no greater return unless you take more risk. But there are plenty of places where you could get a lesser return for taking that risk. See, here's a portfolio at a certain level of risk that gets you this expected return. But you could form another portfolio at the same risk level that got you that return. And you could get even up to the efficient frontier, and you can get that expected return, but no more. That's the thing, though, you see, because if you are investing anywhere except along this frontier, you are inefficient. You are taking, let me show you something. Here, I mentioned this before. Here would be, this is actually on the real frontier, approximately where Microsoft would be. Okay? So, if you look at that, this is the total risk of Microsoft stock. Okay? But for that return to MSFT, you could get something that was on the frontier that had only a piece of that, only a little bit of that risk. Why would you buy a single stock like Microsoft with its overall total risk being what it is, when you could get exactly the same return from something, some animal, and I'll tell you about that here in a little bit, that has extraordinarily less risk? So in other words, by looking at this, we come to understand that total risk has two pieces to it. And I'll begin by giving them, I'll call them, there is this inefficient risk, and there is an efficient risk. Markets are not good or bad. They're not evil or saintly. But they are efficient. The implication of this is that just because you take inefficient risk does not mean the market is ever, ever going to reward you for doing that. Because that's your personal preference. To take a slap across the face. The market will never give you a reward for doing stupid things. Now, in your own life, maybe it will. You know, that's nice. But that's out there in our cuddly, happy, fuzzy world. But in markets, we don't have time to coddle you. So if you feel like you just want to buy Microsoft on its own, you should not expect a return based upon the total risk that you take. You should be expecting a return based only upon the part of the risk that you cannot remove. That's the only reward you're going to get. So now that brings us down to breaking up risk. Total, that sigma, standard deviation we did last week. Now we're seeing that there are two pieces to it, which we will come to talk about. Now, the book uses kind of a weird word for it, but I guess it's okay. But essentially, this is what we call the efficient risk. It's what we call systematic risk. There's another term for it here. Sometimes the book sometimes calls this market risk. There's actually another term that is much wider. We sometimes call this non-diversifiable risk. The systematic is a good term because systematic means that it is in the system itself. Who have I not bothered lately? I'll have to use a guy because it's going to offend a girl. You. Well, it might offend you too. Okay, now, you have a disease in your body. It's in your fat, your bones, your muscles. It's in those gooey, visceral things that go, and when you move and you've eaten too much. Okay? It's in your system. Now, you also have nodules, a couple on your nose, and it's because one of your ancestors was actually a troll, and you never heard about it, but sometimes those troll nodules, and some of them look like a head, and they start talking. But you see, nodules are easy to get rid of. You know, you just like that.
I've done it before.
Yeah, I know. Back in my time, that's how you tried to keep your mother from seeing your acne. I can take care of that. She'd take out the soldering iron. Anyway. But you see, they're not in your system. They're unsystematic. They are easy to get rid of. Getting rid of that stuff that's in your body, in your system, is very difficult. So you see, that's why we call this efficient risk, systematic. You can't get rid of that. You're never going to get rid of that. But this inefficient risk, see all of this inefficient risk right here? You can just buy something that is less risky to get the same return. So we call that non-systematic or unsystematic. Not in the system. Unsystematic or non-systematic risk. You will also see it sometimes called company risk, or I don't like that term because even portfolios can be inefficient. But you see company risk, it's sometimes called what's the term that I'm trying to remember what the book calls this. It's an odd term. But it's just a risk that you don't need to have. And you can make it go away. The whole thing is that there's the key to it right there. You buy more stocks that are not perfectly correlated, and magic happens. Again, I'll have to use a guy for this. Sir, have you ever sung in the shower? Don't lie. You lie. We all do. Okay. Okay. You ever sung in the shower? I heard you singing, you know. It was actually, you know, Luther Vandross, you know, that romantic. I'm wrong. You were singing Barry White. Okay. Don't laugh. You were singing Beyoncé. I know you were. I'm bad at those names. I used to think her name was Bouncy, but I got in so much trouble with a class some years back. Okay, but okay, I'm going to tell you something. You probably are a horrible singer. Don't laugh, you are too. I mean, my God. The dogs were leaving the neighborhood with little backpacks. I'm out of here. That's what you thought were those wolves out there on that foggy road. That was just the dogs who had left town and they were lost in the fog. But here's the thing. Tell you a story. And it's not to bore you, but it's a story that is this. Many, many, many years ago, I had the unfortunate situation where a kid of mine decided she wanted to be in the orchestra at Normal Community West High School. What do you want to play? I want to play a viola. Have you ever heard a bad viola? It's like a bad violin, except that it magnifies at a deeper level and it moves. On the bright side, it actually did loosen a tumor I had. And every night, it was just the same thing. I'd cower in a small part of the house down in the basement, and so would the cats. And then came the horrible, horrible thing. We're having our first concert, Daddy. Oh, dear God. Mother of God. And, you know, I looked into razor blades to slash my wrist, but I finally decided, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm okay. I was a soldier. This can't be that bad. And then this little voice in the back of my head said, oh, it can be worse. The Geneva Convention prevents torture like this in combat situations. Okay, I got to the concert, and here came, they were doing that before the concert, and then they started the first piece. It was amazing. It sounded incredible. It sounded beautiful. That's portfolio diversification. The same thing that happens with people and insurance. Sir, you're going to have diabetes when you're 30. But you're not. You're going to have, I don't know, your skin fall off when you're 50. Don't talk. She was using oil of Olay. You didn't, so it's going to be worse for you. You, sir, are going to have high blood pressure when you're 45. You are going to have a heart attack at 50. You, sir, are going to develop psychosis, specifically Tourette's syndrome. Do you know what Tourette's syndrome is? That's one where just for no reason you start barking and cussing. When I was growing up, there was a guy in town who had that. Kids would hang out just to hear what he had to say. You're going to be handsome and healthy your whole damn life until you die at 60 from a stroke. But do you see what's going on here? You were a healthy child. You were a sickly child. You got sick as a child at a later time than you got sick with the childhood illnesses. All of these things are happening at different times in people's lives. And as that goes on, if you put them all into a pool and take care of all of their medical bills, they smooth each other out. So the entire risk pool has almost perfect predictability. All that's left after you let each other cancel out is the system's risk, the risk of being a human being. That's all it is. This was one of the things that just amazed us about the insurance industry for years and years. Well, we're going to exclude these ethnicities and these people right here. You dumbasses, you're taking away part of what gets rid of the system of the inefficient risk. You see, risk of the individual doesn't really matter in the risk pool. It actually helps. When one person is healthy, the other person is sick. And as long as you don't have perfect correlation, which we measure by that coefficient rho And it's easy to find. I'll show you some charts of it. You actually, the noise cancels part of itself out. There's a YouTube video. It was done some years ago, and there were some criticisms of it. But it showed what happens if in a field of crickets, when you have one cricket, and then you have what would be literally tens or hundreds of thousands of crickets at the same time. If you play that 10,000 crickets at one-third speed, you'd swear you're listening to one of the most incredible symphonies that has ever been written. This is the reality of it. The chaos actually creates predictability and harmony. In exactly the same way as when you look closely at an impressionist painting, it just looks like a mess of colors and splotches. But when you stand back from it, I'll be damned if it doesn't look like the real world and it's beautiful. It's all the same thing. And this stock portfolios, you see what is on that efficient frontier? Those are portfolios that are so well diversified that they've gotten rid of all the risk that they can get. So what does that mean? How big would a portfolio have to be to accomplish getting rid of all that inefficient risk? Well, here's the chart of it. It's kind of a crappy chart. Here is pure market risk down here. Now, what happens if you've got one stock, you've got stupid. But as you add stocks, that inefficient risk melts away. What does that mean in terms of real actionable investment? It would take about 30 stocks to shake out 95% of the inefficient risk. About 30. You get up to about twice that, 60. You get rid of about 97% of the inefficient risk. Do you see that performance envelope? You double it, you get only a few more percent. And so therein lies the problem. If you, I mean, as an individual investor, people say to me, well, I just bought this stock and I made a lot of money, or I'm going long this stock. You hear these idiots on the Financial News Network, buy this stock. That is extraordinarily irresponsible investing. But I don't care if you're doing it for yourself. You can live or die. The real problem comes if you keep doing that once you become responsible for other people. If you're a financial planner, you can't be an irresponsible, well, I'll just buy a stock and see what happens. I'll just take all that inefficient risk. You cannot be that as a manager in a company. Well, we'll just grab a couple of stocks, or we'll invest only in our own company so our employees believe in our company and work hard for it. That is dangerous and irresponsible behavior to do that. As a head of household, you're not responsible for yourself anymore, so you've got to get out of that mentality of buying single stocks or even just a little cluster of stocks, because you're wearing all that inefficient risk that can come back to really kill you. Now, if I had Lyft in a very well-diversified portfolio, I mean, you know, it would have hurt the portfolio a little bit, but it wouldn't have been too bad. But you have it on its own, you just lost your money. You lost your lunch on this one. Yeah, you'll hear this. The problem is that you hear about, well, I invested in a single stock and I made a lot of money. Well, what you never hear about are the 10,000 people who did the same thing and they lost their shirts. You see, there's a bias, a success bias. It's the same one with lottery tickets. All you ever hear about is the one or two people who made a huge fortune in the lottery. You don't hear about the millions and millions who are spending their food money every week just so they can lose more money to the state. You see, so be careful if you're trying to invest in individual stocks. Go ahead and do it when you're not responsible for anyone else, but it's a really bad idea otherwise. Now, this is why. Well, what do you do instead? There are two types of securities that already are well-diversified portfolios, and you can join in those. The two that are already out there are the mutual funds and the ETFs, the electronically traded funds. They are both portfolios of stocks, and you can get a piece of the action. The difference is there are a couple of differences. Now, mutual funds, there are different kinds. There are no load and there are load. Now, a no load means you don't pay a fee to join. A load fund is one where you have to pay a fee to get involved. I strongly recommend you never bother with the load funds. There are thousands and thousands of no load funds. And you can buy all, I think I'll get a mutual fund in the technology sector, or I kind of like global investing. You can find a mutual fund that will do anything you want. But there's a downside. You can move your money in mutual funds. See, if you go, let's say, Fidelity, mutual funds, you can move from one fund to another. Well, I'm kind of scared of stocks right now, so I'll move from an equity fund to a bond fund, some of my money, something like that. You can do that 4 times a year without cost, but you can't do it more than that. You're stuck to your trades on the quarter. Okay, so that's you can't react quickly, so you have to control what you're doing. Now, in a good market, what you would probably do with mutual funds is you'd have a bond mutual, an equity mutual, and then you'd have something we call a cash. That's an investment in just purely no-risk treasuries. And in a good market, you might say 20% bonds, 75% equity mutual, and maybe 5% in cash for shuttling purposes. Now, in a bad market, you would probably go flight to quality. You'd move this way, probably 60% and 25% and 15% would be your portfolio allocation scheme. So you have to keep an eye, be aware of the economy, use what I'm teaching you and what other professors are teaching you to know when it's time to reallocate your assets in your portfolio. But you don't go crazy, well, I'm going to change every... No, watch for the signs. Don't go flip happy every time you have a window, well, I'm going to shuttle some stuff around. But you do keep an eye on the performance of your mutual fund. You've got an equity fund that's not doing as great as it should. Go ahead, move it to something that looks like it's doing better. And I'll show you how you can do that analysis in the next couple of lectures. And maybe somewhere here in the middle, you'd have sort of a middling kind of portfolio, maybe 45, 45, and 10% if the economy is kind of in a quiet, you know, not very exciting phase. Okay, so there's that. Now, ETFs are different. An ETF, and I've shown you ETFs, I've been doing a cut one. An ETF is actually a stock. It has a trading symbol, just like a stock does. It trades on an exchange, just like a stock does. And you can buy and sell it anytime you want, just like a stock. And you can find an ETF that does anything you want. For example, I'll show you. Come on. There's some reason this computer sucks. Oh, we're going to install updates. Yes, I was really looking forward to that. Sorry. Okay, I'll turn down the light here. This is the classic spider. You buy it like a stock. It's just a plain old freaking stock. But that stock is the Standard & Poor's 500. You would own, in exactly the right proportions by balance, the Standard & Poor's 500. if you had that portfolio, if you bought that stock. One share of it, one spider, you are at the top of the world. You own, well, yes, I invest in the Standard & Poor's 500. Uh-huh. Yeah. That gives you an idea. You could buy a round lot of this for about, with commission, it's going to be about $4,000. And then you would ride the Standard & Poor's 500. You would ride exactly the S&P 500. The problem, of course, is that you can trade anytime, day or night. You eat a bad pizza, and at 2 o'clock you wake up and you need to make a trade. You feel like that'll doing some trading. Well, you can do it. But, of course, just like a stock, you pay a commission every time. Well, I never pay a commission. I use Robinhood. Yes, you do. You're just too stupid to see it. Jeez. Anyway. So there. That is. No. Oh, by the way. Oh, God. What's the ETF one? Oh, come on. I can't remember. There's an ETF. I've been doing ETFs in my investment class, and they're coming to be like a blur to me. But there's one for the NASDAQ. You buy that ETF, you own the NASDAQ. Well, you own a tiny piece of it. But you could buy one for the Dow. You could buy one that is a global ETF. It buys stocks and puts them into a portfolio from all around the world. You could do any, there's an ETF for everything. The upside is you can trade anytime you want, which you can't do with mutual funds. The downside is there's a commission on every trade, which there is not with the mutual funds. But if you're looking to create portfolios, this is the way you do it. And I've said this before, and I'll make it clear now again. All of these money managers and all this that talk about how hard they work for their commissions, and we are analyzing stocks all the time, no, they're not. They're indexers. In other words, they're buying index portfolios. They're buying ETFs. That's how they're doing it. You would be stupid to try to analyze individual stocks on your own and pay the commission for building big, huge portfolios and all that. Most of them play the indexes. And here's what we know about it. For the ninth year in a row, indexers got higher returns than active portfolio managers for the ninth year in a row. In other words, the ones who really do watch stocks all the time, buy and build these well-diversified portfolios, 30 stocks, 60 stocks, 100 stocks, they do not do as well as those who just go out and buy some ETFs. Buy a portfolio of 5 different ETFs to create super diversification and get really close to that frontier up there. It is so much easier, and your returns are going to be higher year after year after year. In the professional level, at the pro level, the pros who index, who just do indexing, outperform the pros who do active portfolio management. So it's almost like it's not even worth it anymore. From everything we can see, just go and do this. Now, I want to point out something important. Whether you want to be an active portfolio manager or you want to be an indexer, in either case, you're obviously going to have to hold more than one security in order to do that. Well, actually, I better leave that up here. Even, see, the Standard & Poor's 500 index, the SPDR, that is holding 70% of the world's value, 70% of the total market cap of the world, it's something around there, is in the Standard & Poor's 500 companies. So you've got amazing global diversification, but you don't have perfect global diversification. That's why you want to put, even in, if you've got an ETF, get a few ETFs. Even if you've got a mutual fund, don't go with one mutual fund. You might want to do maybe 3 in the bonds, 3 in the equities, and 1 in the cash. The cash really doesn't matter. So that you get them canceling out each other's final bit of noise, okay? However, How do you know how to do that? Whether you're in stocks or bonds, let me, if I ever had the sense, I would eventually get my own bookmarks in here. I'm looking for portfolio visualizer. There it is. This, you give this stock trading symbols, and it will tell you how correlated the stocks are. See, you don't want correlation because then they're not canceling each other out. You want low correlation. The lower the correlation between two stocks, the more they cancel out each other's inefficient risk. So you're looking for stocks that have low portfolio low correlation coefficients. Now, how low is low? Every investment analyst is going to tell you a different number, I think. I always say I wouldn't put stocks or ETFs together in a portfolio if they had a correlation coefficient above 0.3. But let me just throw in a few here, just so you can see this in action. This is what you would do to build a portfolio, whether it's stocks or ETFs. I'll do it with stocks. So anyone got a stock to want to put in? Don't say Lyft. What is it? Do you have a trading symbol? SYF. Is that Sci-Fi Channel? No. Okay. What else? TSLA. Okay. How about Target? What else? NFLX. NFLX. Maybe Facebook, FB. Apple, AAPL. MSFT. Just so you can see what happens, what the correlation coefficients look like. And let's do Kellogg. And what is? AMZN. Oh, and I'll do Caterpillar too, KAT. Now, what you're going to get is a correlation coefficient matrix. There we go. Okay. Synchrony Financial against Tesla. Very low correlation. They're not in the same business at all. You notice the only one that gets up there are these high-tech stocks, which is kind of weird. And Caterpillar? Oh, because of the financing. They're both interest rate sensitive. Okay. Now we can look at others. Just scanning across here to look what would not be a good idea. Tesla against Netflix. Why those two are... Sometimes you can obvious... Oh, it's obvious why they're correlated so much. Other times it's like WTF. Look at, for example, this is obvious. Apple against Microsoft. Okay, that's, you would never want to put those in the same portfolio because they're not canceling out each other's inefficient risk too much. But if you look at one that is a little bit less obvious to me is Apple is highly correlated with both Amazon and CAT. Now, I might be able to fashion some kind of a crappy argument for the high correlation between Apple and Amazon, but I got nothing with CAT. I got nothing. They're not even the same consumer markets. But that's just the reality of it. Notice, interestingly enough, that Kellogg is low correlation with almost everything, with everything in here, which means that Kellogg would be a good addition to any portfolio. Although it's got a low beta, so any addition to a low-risk portfolio. Amazon against Microsoft, yeah, I already talked about that. It's a symmetric, obviously, matrix. But I'm just looking to see if there's anything else that hits me right between the eyes. Look at Netflix against Facebook, Netflix against Apple. All of these, Netflix against Amazon, all of these new companies, new age, new tech, new this, new that, new you tomorrow if you eat these pills, they all seem to have a strong correlation. So when I hear people, and this is something, I invest in technologies. Okay, you're investing badly because you're probably buying stocks that are highly correlated. You're not getting rid of your diversifiable, unsystematic company risk very efficiently at all if all you do is buy into a single sector. And that's something that's really important in this. Invest not just in companies in different sectors and industries, but also invest globally. Because I can guarantee you that a company in the United States, no matter how much it brags about how global it is going to have a low correlation coefficient, quite likely, with a company in Europe or Eastern Europe or Asia, which doesn't face the same economic forces, which doesn't face the same markets at all. The more you invest globally, the faster you get your portfolio risk down. So when you're buying ETFs or mutual funds, that doesn't mean you always just buy something that says global on it. Some of that can be really crap. They're saying global and it's not really global at all. But you look for companies, if you're investing, look for companies that have company names with GmbH or PLC at the end of them instead of INC. Look for the global market. And so that's one of the most important things is when you are building your portfolio, whether it's ETFs or whatever, you've got to get this correlation coefficients to be acceptable, within an acceptable range. And don't ever, ever, one last thing about this, don't ever buy a stock because you like the company. Don't ever buy a stock because a friend of yours works there or thinks this is a good idea. You like a company? That's wonderful. Shop there. You like a company? That's wonderful. Tell your friends to shop there. But your personal preferences should have nothing to do with your investments. That's all I have for you today. Go home.